please.
Steve Hanlon with Holland & Knight on behalf of the claimant.
Robin Uricchio Quinn for Holland & Knight on behalf of the claimant.
Martha Barnett of Holland & Knight on behalf of the claimant.
And Mr. DeGrande, the sponsor, is with us this morning. Mr. Peters?
James Peters for the state of Florida.
Okay. I had requested prior to the hearing and have received the list of witnesses and documents. At this point, I'd like to go through the documents and mark them and go ahead and put them on the record. The first thing that we have is the report. And, Lynn, if you'll mark this composite one for the claimant. Now, I'm taking the subject to your specific objection. So, Mr. Peters, if you want to put that on the record.
For the record, the state has multiple hearsay objections to the contents of the report, contents of the appendices, and the contents of the criticism of the two documents.
Okay. The second document I have is the review of the Rosewood Project by Richard Greaves and Patrick Reardon. Mark that number two, claimants. And I'm not sure, do you want to...
Same objection for all three documents, Mr.
Okay. I've taken the appendix as part of the composite one. Do we have any other documents that we want to take at this time, or do you want to wait till you got the witness?
I think it'd go just as smoothly if we waited until we got the witnesses.
Okay.
That's okay with you.
That's fine with me.
For the record, it's my intention, although I object based on hearsay to the contents of much of this, to use many of the newspaper articles that are referenced in the bibliography to the report.
Okay. Yeah, I understand what your objection is.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we are going to do today has nothing to do with the vote on the bill. Our purpose today is to gather evidence so that Mr. Kearns and myself will be able to write a report and recommendation to the legislature pertaining to the bill, House Bill 591, and to recommend to the legislature what to enact the bill favorably or to amend the bill or to vote the bill unfavorably. So the purpose today for any of you who have not been to a claim bill proceeding is purely evidentiary. To the witnesses, this is not a court proceeding. This is an informal proceeding. Your attorneys are going to ask you questions. Mr. Peters may ask you questions. Mr. Kearns and I may ask you questions. I don't want you to feel uncomfortable. If at any time you need to leave the room or you need to get a glass of water or something, the Sarge's folks are over here and they'll help you with that. Because we're not used to having this many people here, we have had to accommodate you with some unique surroundings here. We're going to ask you to testify into a microphone at the end of the table, and I don't think you'll have any problems with that. Mr. Hanlon and Mr. Peters will try, and if they need to come down and give you a document to look at, we'll try and get them down there without a whole lot of confusion. But just feel real comfortable. This isn't the court, and you don't have anything to worry about. I've asked both of the attorneys to do a brief opening statement. As you can imagine, Mr. Kearns and I are somewhat familiar with these bills. We've read them, and so I'd like you to be fairly brief, but at the same time, tell us where you're going to go today and the nature of the evidence that you're going to proceed with today. And Mr. Peters, I've asked you to also give me an opening before you begin your process. I'd like you to do that after Mr. Hanlon. Go ahead.
All right.
Thank you. Excuse me 1 second. Mr. DeGrande, did you want to make some remarks before we started?
Sure. Seriously, I realize this is a much different proceeding than I'm accustomed as a member to participate in. However, I have introduced every bill that I have had the opportunity to present before this legislature, and I feel particularly proud to be able to introduce this bill. I have worked with both the attorneys in this case. I have worked with Mr. Hanlon for about a year and a half, preparing for a day like today where we could present this case to you. I have worked with Mr. Peters, although on the other side of the table during the reapportionment process. I find them both to be honorable men very competent attorneys, and I'm sure that they will make a very good presentation before the special master and down the line before the legislature. The difference, I think, in this representation between Mr. Peters and I is that although we are both public servants, Mr. Peters has a duty as an honorable man and as an attorney to zealously represent his client. And his client is the state of Florida. My duty as a representative is different. My duty is to represent the people that seek justice before their government. And that's what I'm here to do today with the Rosewood Bill. In 1923, there was a community called Rosewood, a community that today does not exist as a result of hate, as a result of racism, and as a result of violence. And I think what makes Rosewood unique is that the government knew what was happening in Rosewood. The government owed a duty to its citizens and failed in its moral, legal, equitable obligations to protect its citizens. And as a result of the failure of our government to do what it should for every one of our citizens, today there is no community in Rosewood. There is no place of worship in Rosewood. There are no homes. People were murdered. There exists nothing but a road marker. And that is wrong. And we had the opportunity as a state to prevent that and did not prevent that. I have heard arguments that we should not deal with Rosewood 70 years later. And I will not go into the facts because the lawyers are going to present the facts. But from the moral and equitable perspective, as an equitable body that we are, I think we must. And if we look at precedent within ourselves as a legislature and as an institution, there is, for example, even today in our society, no statute of limitations for murder. And I submit to you that if one of the citizens that committed the murders in Rosewood would be found today and the evidence was there to convict them, the state would be compelled to proceed 70 years later, because that's how important we view these acts as a society, and we must respond. And we must respond to the citizens of Rosewood that at that time, because of hate and racism, did not have a proper forum in which to place their claims and grievances before the state. I have heard that to compensate the victims of the Rosewood Massacre would open a Pandora's box. I have heard arguments, for example, that need we not compensate the Indians for takings of their lands if we compensate the victims of Rosewood? I submit to you that however wrong people may believe those acts were, we were a sovereign nation at war with another sovereign nation, and we owed no legal duty as the duty we owed to our citizens. That's why we did not owe a legal duty to Japan when we dropped the atomic bomb. But fortunately, the federal government has finally realized that we owed a legal duty to citizens of this country of Oriental descent for the unlawful deprivation of liberty that we committed upon them during World War II. I have heard, for example, that if we compensate the victims of Rosewood, must not we compensate every black citizen in the state of Florida for the crimes during slavery? Well, as heinous and atrocious and as repugnant as you and I and every member of the legislature find slavery to be, there was a time when it was legal. And if a human being could be considered property, there could be no deprivation of human or civil rights of that individual. And there came a time in this country when we as Americans became enlightened. And it took us a civil war to reread what was written hundreds of years ago and to realize that all citizens are created equal and that all citizens are entitled to due process and equal protection of the law. And so today, the citizens named in the Rosewood Bill come to us as a legislature, either personally or through their descendants, to seek justice. Justice not because of the color of their skin, but because of their condition as proud, free, and equal citizens of this nation and of the great state of Florida. And I am convinced as a legislator then when we as a body evaluate the facts and weigh the equities, we will be compelled to find that their cause and their claim is just. Thank you, Mr. Hickson.
You ready?
Sure.
Okay, Mr. Hamlin, wherever you want to be comfortable, usually the attorneys just stay right there.
Okay.
Just make sure your mic's on.
My mic is on.
Okay.
First of all, on behalf of my clients, the Rosewood family, and on behalf of my law firm, Holland & Knight, I want to express our deep appreciation to the state of Florida, and particularly to those public servants in the state of Florida who have made this day possible. The old bromide, better late than never, if it was ever applicable, is probably applicable here today. I particularly want to thank Speaker Johnson, for the considerations that he has given to make sure that there would be a fair and open hearing here today. We also are deeply indebted to Representative DeGrande and, of course, Representative Lawson, who, as we know, most of us probably know, can't be here today because of the death of his father. This is a good day for Florida, and I think we can be proud that we have a forum here to deal with what is a very, very difficult issue. The principal issue that's in front of us today is whether or not the state has a moral obligation to compensate the victims of the Rosewood massacre. I frankly do not think that both Mr. Peters and I have briefed this matter, and I think it's clear now where we probably have disputes and where we probably don't have disputes. And what I'd like to do here today for you, both of you, is to outline what I think those issues are, where we do have disputes, where we don't, and then what the evidence will be on the disputed issues. I don't think there's any serious dispute that under a fairly traditional equal protection analysis, the state cannot condition the police power on one's race. I don't expect to have the state argue that the state can say to one race, I will provide police power to you, and to another race, I will not provide police power to you when you need it. And I don't think there's any serious question, whatever, that that's exactly what happened in this case. I don't expect the state to say that that didn't happen in this case. It's clear, even though the evidence is 70 years old, and even though, as Mr. Peters argues, there's some hearsay nature to it, it is clear here that if Rosewood had been a predominantly white town surrounded by 400 angry black people, that town would have received the police protection from the state, and it would have been saved from destruction. So I don't think there's any major dispute about either the nature of the claim or what happened in Rosewood. I also don't think, and it's clear from reading Mr. Peters' brief, which I found to be a very responsible and thoughtful brief, I don't think there's any question that the state knows that these folks were really seriously harmed. This is a major traumatic event in their life, and I'm going to describe to you later what evidence we intend to put on to that effect. The damage they suffered is similar to the damage that Holocaust victims would suffer and has endured with them all their lives down to the present day. The Rosewood Massacre, from my client's point of view, is not some long-forgotten, ancient, unfortunate chapter in Florida's, unfortunately, sometimes violent and racially troubled past. It is, and I'm convinced that you will be convinced of this, a deep, dark, present reality in my clients' lives today, tomorrow, the next day, and has been for this entire period of time. It has brutally disrupted their lives. And it has changed their lives in ways that we will never really fully understand. Where I think, and I really don't think the state is going to seriously contest that. Where I think we have a dispute are in two areas that are really peripheral to the facts that you're going to hear today. The one is a kind of statute of limitations claim. Why wasn't this claim brought earlier? It's a 70-year-old claim. But I think even the state will acknowledge that our clients were witnesses to murders which were not prosecuted by the state. As such, we almost really don't even need to put ourselves in the shoes of our clients. We all could understand, even never having been there, that if that had happened to us, we would fear for our safety for the rest of our lives. We would fear that if anyone ever found out about it, or certainly if we ever sued, he just walked in and I've forgotten. I want to thank Senator Jones, too. Senator Jones played a very important role in this, and I left you out and I forgot there, Senator, and I apologize to you. Thank you.
Excuse me, Sarge, do we have a place for the Senator Jones?
We all would know that we would be fearful forever coming forward and certainly forever attacking or suing the state that had not prosecuted that crime. As Representative DeGrande mentioned, there is no statute of limitations on murder. People know that. And I believe you will be convinced when we conclude here today that our client's fear was an entirely rational, understandable fear and justifies, I think the Florida Supreme Court's test is extraordinary circumstances, and these are certainly extraordinary circumstances. They're not coming forward and suing the very state that failed to protect them back then. And I think the evidence will be that there was you'll hear evidence of a man and woman who were married for 50 years and never talked about it. That the secrecy that was maintained for fear of harm to their children, to their wives, to their families, was real and deep. And I believe you will feel comfortable at the end recommending to the legislature that the state not hide behind the statute of limitations in this case. The second argument, I think, where we have a dispute, and Representative DeGrande has touched on this, is the question of precedent and the problem of precedent. Rosewood was unique. We don't have, to our knowledge, another case where the state can have had so much time to act and was so clearly on notice in time to prevent the harm. And Rosewood can be distinguished that way from everything that we know about other serious problems in our state's past. It is also the only case that we're aware of where the land was simply confiscated. I mean, it was taken from them. There was no way to return to it. And it is, therefore, unique in our history. And I believe that at the conclusion of the evidence in this case, you will be able to write a report and a recommendation to the legislature in which you can tell them that it is unique and that it will not set up a precedent that they need to be concerned about. And it's our duty to give you the evidence to make that finding, and I'm hopeful that you can. You will hear testimony today from four survivors who will tell you, who were then children, one as old as 16 at the time, who will describe to you what happened. You'll hear from a woman who was in the carrier house. You'll hear from a man who was in the carrier house at the time. And so you'll have a fairly good sense of what happened at Rosewood. I think you'll also have a fairly good sense from them of their fear of ever discussing this matter, and certainly a fear of ever coming forward to sue the state that didn't protect them then. You'll hear from children of them, because Rosewood had an effect on the children of these folks, and you'll hear how it had an effect on the parenting relationship between them and their folks. You'll hear from Arnett Doctor, who is a child, a woman, young girl then, at Rosewood, who brought this family forward, along with Benny Lee Langley and Lee Ruth Davis, who is no longer with us. Lee Ruth was there and has died since we began since we first filed a claims bill in this matter. And you'll hear the struggle of the family about whether or not to talk about this, whether or not to come forward, the deep misgivings they had, the anger that there was for anybody talking about this outside the family, and then eventually the death of the matriarch of the family and folks beginning then to barely come forward. You also hear from a really noted psychologist at the University of Florida, Dr. Carolyn Tucker, who I think will be able to provide you exceptional testimony based on her interviews of people who were there at the time, people who will testify before you here today. And I think Dr. Tucker's testimony will...
Are we having Dr. Tucker today?
Yes, we are. Okay. And I think Dr. Tucker's testimony will convince you again of two things: the enormous damage that was inflicted on the psychological and emotional lives of our clients. I think that you will conclude after hearing that testimony that post-traumatic stress syndrome is an appropriate classification for the conditions that have existed in our clients' lives. And on both that issue and on the issue of the statute of limitations, I do not believe that you need an individualized inquiry. I believe that you will be able to tell from the evidence here today that those conditions were widespread, in fact, uniform throughout the claimants. That the claimants, not to anyone's surprise, I mean, I really don't think this is highly complex at this point.
Let me ask you a question. What do we have in the way of evidence about the property itself? Do we have...
Whatever's in the reports and...
We have the tax. I think in the report there's three people that are identified as being on the tax roll.
Right.
Do we have anything beyond that?
No. Okay. We are not, you'll see from the damage, and I want to make that clear now, the damage claim is not, the property is not a significant factor in the damage claim. The real damage to our clients was the loss of that entire community. It's what's called hedonic damages. You have a community, an intact African-American, industrious, really sufficient community with churches, school, a Masonic lodge, baseball team, baseball field, houses, six, maybe six, eight of the houses, two-story houses, pianos in the houses, organ in the houses, businesses in the community, turpentine stills, independent folk trappers, etc. This is a remarkable African-American community that existed. It had its ups and its downs. It had its economic ups and downs, just like everybody else did. But to lose, continuity of that community and be scattered throughout the state and the nation, as these people were, is the core of the damage claim. Literally, as I've said before, and I'll say it again, the property damage claim is a pebble in that beach. And we will present testimony from an economic expert next week that the amounts sought by the claimants here are remarkably low in terms of the true value of those claims in any American courtroom today. And that testimony will be based in part on Dr. Tucker's testimony with respect to the psychological damage that has been done to our clients. And again, I want to stress that I do not believe that you, I hope that at the conclusion of the hearing you will be in a position to recommend to the legislature that on the issue of the statute of limitation, on the issue of damages, there is no need for any individualized inquiry. This was a group harm, and it needs a group remedy. And it's our job to give you the evidence to support the group nature of the harm and the fear.
Have we resolved the issue relating to the claimant list? Is that something we're going to deal with next week?
Well, here's what I hope we come out of here with, and this is based on some pre-trial, pre-hearing discussions that we've had. And it's not just what I hope, this is what my clients, our clients, have consistently sought and felt somewhat constricted by the claims bill procedure. I hope that when we come out of here, that you will be in a position to make a recommendation of state liability and a recommendation of that an appropriate fund be established to compensate the claimants who can establish their claimant status. I think that we need to come out of here. The third thing I think we need to come out of here with is a definition of who is an appropriate claimant. Right now, the definition includes those who lived in Rosewood, as well as those in the surrounding vicinity with ties to Rosewood, and that's a determination that you need to make, I think. And if we come out of here with a recommendation on liability, a recommendation on an amount, and I expect that your recommendation, I hope that the testimony will establish to you that the amount sought is so low compared to what would ordinarily be sought in a court, given the considerations that our clients had in discussions with legislators, particularly sponsoring legislators, before filing the claims bill, that you will agree that that amount is appropriate. It'll never be sufficient. I mean, we could never adequately compensate.
You're satisfied with the $7 million figure as being the appropriate figure for us to be discussing in these proceedings?
I'm satisfied that in discussions with the representatives or the sponsors of this bill, that is that's the figure we should ask for. I'm equally satisfied that a true figure would be much, much, much higher than that, and that my clients have been very, very.
For our purposes, we're talking.
That's what we're talking about.
Of that figure.
That's exactly right, and I believe that we will put on evidence to you that a true figure would be many times that amount.
On behalf of the state, I would respectfully submit that $7 million is not an insignificant amount. Indeed, there is total disagreement. Variety of procedure and claims bill when the class has not been defined, when elements of proof required for claimant status have not been accomplished. So that's definitely an area that we have deep-seated disagreement.
For the purposes of today, let's not discuss the amounts, because I think as we work our way through the testimony, it's going to naturally come forward. But I wanted a figure that we were all in the ballpark with, and you're not adjusting that from what I hear today. We're sticking with the $7 million.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right. I just didn't. You said satisfied, and our clients are here, and I don't want to say that satisfied on that when I know that the evidence is going to be that it would be many times that.
I understand, but okay. I need a ballpark to start.
Sure. I understand that. And I think Mr. Peters is right. This is a process that we believe would be a very good process. It's very similar to the process that was used under the Japanese Reparations Act. And that was an act that was worked out by the United States Congress in 1988. I think it has it's a very helpful analog for the state of Florida to use. There then needs to be a process for claimants to come forward, and in a fairly short time. We're dealing with aging people. So we need a fairly short process for folks to come forward. And I would hope that there could be some funds allocated to locate others who might be true claimants under a definition which you would recommend to the legislature here based on what you hear in the testimony here. Because there are, we believe, at least 10 or 15 more, and maybe more than that.
And that was my concern, because
right.
I think all of you have had contacts from people who have expressed a relationship to the incidents that we're going to hear about today. And I didn't want to preclude, by going forward with the list you have right now, the potential claimants that there might be as the evidence unfolds. So
exactly.
We're proceeding with that as a given, that there might be some other people that could have a claim based upon whatever evidence comes forward.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you're going to hopefully receive an evidence, a letter which will show you that that's been our client's position all along. We'd like that kind of process for claimant identification after a definition.
So this was really your good faith effort at the time that the bill had to be filed.
Exactly. We were a little bit under the gun. It had to be filed by January 1. And
Absolutely.
And we understood that's all we could do in a claims bill process, but we're hopeful, and we've continually pressed for people to think of other more creative ways to work with it, and I'm hopeful that can evolve out of it.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Finally, this is a difficult task. It's a difficult issue, and it's a difficult remedy task. Okay. But it can be done. It was done by the Congress in the Japanese Reparations Act. And I do not believe that it will, if done properly, undermine the state treasury. Governments which come forward and acknowledge problems in their past, as the United States government is doing right now with the radiation experiments, are good governments, and that's a good way to govern. And it can be done. It's difficult, but ignoring the problem and pretending that it didn't exist and hoping that it would just go away and not creatively devising a remedy, which is really what I'm urging you to do here in this case, is a serious mistake. And we can devise a remedy here, and you can make findings here about the uniqueness of this situation, which will not open the Pandora's box, which people have expressed concern about. Thank you.
Okay. Usually I ask the state to wait till we do the evidence, but I think it would be helpful to us to hear from you at this point. So if you would go ahead.
Thank you. Notwithstanding our differences, this really is a good day for the state. Notwithstanding our differences, I'm pleased to be able to meet the claimants today. We do obviously have profound differences of opinion as to what a proper claims process is and should be, and we do not feel this is appropriate for this procedure. Unfortunately, as a matter of Florida history, much of what counsel summarized, much of what Mr. DeGrande summarized, the facts of this case are true. Fortunately for the state, I would say that some things they summarized are not accurate, and we'll have the opportunity to air that today in hopefully an objective forum. Make no doubt about it, this is a claim about a societal wrong, one of too many. I recall approximately 50 or 60 lynchings, violence which towns were affected are reported in the team report. And I would, we all admit this is a sorry damn period in Florida's history. Make no doubt about it. Deaths of innocent citizens occurred, property was destroyed, and families were displaced by the violence. We should be ashamed of that. We are. I respectfully disagree, however, that insofar as entertaining a claims bill process, Rosewood is really not that unique, unfortunately. And whatever damage and trauma were visited upon the claimants, and we'll have the opportunity to prove that later, I respectfully submit that that damage, that trauma, is no greater than the damage or trauma to other families of any race that have been lynched or murdered or have felt that the state's law enforcement powers didn't do justice to their claim. It's sad, it's sorry, it's tragic, but I disagree that Rosewood really is not unique. With my apologies, I met some of the claimants this morning, Mrs. Langley, Mrs. Jenkins, Mr. Hall, Mr. Goins, Dr. Evans, and I don't mean to offend anyone by not naming you. I respectfully submit, and I would submit to the special master, that you're asking too much of the claims process, too much of the state of Florida, to come forward after over a generation, 71 years, and ask for the state, based upon what we all have to concede is hearsay evidence, family stories revisited in good faith, no doubt, and particularly to do that in the absence of the state officials, county officials, who are either impliedly or expressly accused in the claims bill of these wrongs. On behalf of the state, I would say that's not fair. One of the issues to be resolved here, and one that we do disagree with emphatically, is, as counsel indicated, the necessity for each of the claimants to step forward. I would submit, before there can be any fair determination of these issues from anybody's perspective, it's essential, it's required as a matter of fair notice to the state, for the claimants who have failed to step forward to present themselves and explain why. No doubt, this record will show errors in judgment of state and county officials in failing to anticipate the extent of violence as it escalated 71 years ago. I would submit, however, that this record will not show errors in judgment of the extent that would amount to a constitutional wrong, as case law now or then define that, or that even would amount to gross negligence as case law now defines it. I've briefed the law in my memorandum. I hopefully have agreement that that's a good law. If it isn't, I'm sure Mr. Hamlin will tell me.
Yeah, and you know, today for purposes of moving along, I have read your memorandum of law, and I am in the process of reading your cases, and there are significant cases that I think have some relevance to our inquiry here. But I don't particularly want to talk about that today.
I think
when we conclude the proceedings, I'll go through that with you, and I might ask you for some supplemental memos in regard to those issues. Okay?
Indeed, I would suggest that the conclusions of the university team at the final pages of the report, while damning 19, 20 officials in general, does not on its face, or as reasonably construed, attribute to these officials, either the governor, the sheriff of Levy County, of Alachua County, or the state attorney, the culpabilities that would be required under the claim as presented, that is, constitutional violations and gross negligence. We are in agreement that the record will show a series of escalating violence in this small community, going from one-on-one, two-on-one, to the destruction of your homes, your relatives' homes, on the seventh day. We would suggest that the record will also show, however, good faith efforts, although less than perfectly implemented, of a county official, leading sheriff, of a county official, the Alachua sheriff, to contain violence. We would also suggest the record will show a good faith exchange, although evidenced by faded copies of newspaper reports, wherein the governor, having learned of the violence, inquired of the sheriff, and was in fact informed, and I think it was the fifth day, by telegram, again, because of the passage of time, we don't have other documents of that, the situation is in hand. And that is, in fact, the same day that the Alachua sheriff, having come to this small town, likewise observed the situation was at hand and retreated. I would submit there is no evidence in the record. There is no evidence in these clippings. And I would submit there can be no evidence from the few persons who can testify today from first-person knowledge that there was any reason for the Florida governor to disbelieve the assessment of the Levy sheriff, to disbelieve the assessment of the Alachua sheriff, that things were under control. No reason. And I would submit that absent proof of that level of incompetence or distrust, the governor rightfully relied upon what he was told. The record as it is, and we do have multiple overlapping hearsay problems with it, the record as it is on its face shows contradictions that are seemingly unresolvable at this late date, again because of passage of time. And that compounds my ability to defend the state, and I would submit it fatally precludes presentations of your claims at this late date because my witnesses are not alive. My records are not available. And the passage of time has precluded the state from responding to your assertions made in good faith as to what happened. I can't speak through the lips of dead officials. Let me suggest, just for time being, some of the contradictions in this process that should be apparent to all of you here to look.
You want to do that now? You
want to go just a few. Just a few.
Okay.
There's an admirable attempt in the chronology of events at page 3 to set forth in some order some of the significant events that occurred in Rosewood 21 years ago. One of these items is a brief description on January 4, 1923, which said...
I need to catch up with you. What page are you on?
Page 3.
Okay.
Late evening, white vigilantes attacked Carrier House. And in fact, we know there was a gun battle at the Carrier House, and we know that persons died at the Carrier House, and we know that some children underwent some horrible experiences after that. We admit that. However, page 40 of the report, notwithstanding the description in the summary of, quote, white vigilantes attacked the Carrier household, suggests something quite contrary about the exchange of gunfire. According to newspaper descriptions, and I'm quoting now, the blacks inside opened fire. Those who were armed had shotguns, and two white men fell dead. Some accounts have the whites firing first. In fact, the record would suggest from the newspaper accounts, we can't tell from the record as it is who initiated this violence, which in fact precipitated the remaining days of violence. Other example, and I'll just give two more and I'll move on.
Yeah, we've read this, and I understand that there are some contradictions, and there will be, because we had newspaper accounts, we had, and resolving all that is going to be very difficult.
There are, in fact, sworn statements or narratives from claimants which directly contradict the basis of the claim. I'll move on. I just want everyone to understand these are not reconcilable at this late date because of the passage of time.
And I think for purposes of your opening and what's in your memo, apparent, and it will be apparent to anybody who reads this record, that there are contradictory statements throughout the records we have available to us.
The record will demonstrate that Rosewood, Florida, was a tiny, remote community with no reported history of racial violence. There was not Klan activity. In fact, Klan activity, notwithstanding newspaper reports, did not occur. The record will reflect that this population coexisted without the type of violence that the report suggests otherwise occurred in Florida, at least in the date in question. That